The subject of the day. I told you, how did he pronounce that? Was it prions or prions?
You're asking me?
Yeah. It was...
You may want to ask Patrick. He's
proteins,
better educated than I am.
Proteins in the brain.
Yeah.
And it's we got a couple of texts talking about soil. It's not indigenous to the soil. It's passed from one animal to the next. And so that's pretty cool. We're going to give... We're going to give
the other side of the story,
so to speak. Although I talked with Kyle Clark earlier today, and he's like, "Hey, look, man, I can't go toe to toe on data with Charles Ruth," and I'm like,
"So,
not asking you to."
Want your opinion?
Yeah, want
That's
your
all
opinion
we want.
As the owner
That's what
of
this
a.
Station's
I
all
mean,
about.
You're looking at the possibility of losing your business in South Carolina. Now, obviously, Doc's Deer Sense...
nationwide.
Yeah, they go nationwide. But so we'll talk to Kyle Clark later on in the show. We're also going to talk about how to hunt beaver ponds for ducks. Charles said, man, you love to see where I'm at. I'm down in the river bottom with a Labrador Retriever. I'm like, you got your shotgun with you? Take you a few summer ducks.
Cut them.
I mean, what's going to happen? DNR going to give you a ticket or what? All right. So, and we will round out our show with the parting shot from, we were talking about Wisconsin, but oh, that's a big deer hunting state. Well, they finally got some elk, and their inaugural elk hunt didn't go so well.
It had a curveball.
But in the meantime,
oh my goodness, Patrick was giving you the no look, like, you know, like he wasn't paying attention. Yeah, Patrick's on it, man. Patrick's a good guy. I like Patrick. Okay, here we go. I'm gonna do a venison dish with my favorite vegetables of all kind, and that would be beans. All right, and this is a little sad. There may be a lot of sound effects while I'm reading this recipe. I just feel that that's going to happen, okay? Somehow, some way. All right, venison baked beans. Oh, my goodness. Okay, the first thing you need to start with is 1 pound of thick sliced bacon, and I like to dice it up. And I also like to take 1 pound of ground venison. Stop that, man. I ain't no way I'm going to be able to do this when you're doing that. Okay. All right. We need
Sorry
two,
about that.
It's okay, man. I figured it was coming.
You just got to trim through it, man.
We need two large sweet onions diced, okay? Now, here's where the secret of making great baked beans, okay, by doing it this way. Great northern beans, 48 ounces of them. And through my years of experience, the ones that comes in the jar seem to be a lot fresher and a lot better than the ones that comes in the can.
The white beans?
Yes, great northern beans, all right? And then you need a quarter cup of dark molasses, all right, a quarter cup of brown sugar, some garlic, salt, and pepper, all right? What you're going to do to begin this recipe is you're going to fry the bacon together with a little bit of the chopped onion until it's almost done. Get all that getting up in there and the bacon getting nice and brown and crispy. And then you're going to remove that and drain. All right, then you're going to fry the venison, go right back in the same pan with some more of the chopped onions. Get that flavor going on, all right? Use more onion than with the bacon and then remove and drain, all right? So you put a little more onion with the venison so that flavor can mix with the venison. In a large bowl, combine the beans, molasses, sugar, garlic, salt, and pepper to taste, all right? Add the bacon and the venison and then rest. And the rest of the onion, all right? So whatever onion you had left, all this is going into the pot. And then at this point, I take a big spoon, and I work it and mix it all together real good. And then I just take that whole apparatus and pour it in my crock pot, and I put it on high for 2 hours. And, man, in 2 hours, you'll start – the smell will start first, okay? And then it's going to be fantastic, and it'll be some probably the best baked beans you ever had. And actually, you cooking it like this, it keeps down on all the sound effects quite a bit that we were having in the beginning of this here recipe.
Where's the fun in that?
Well, to me and my wife, that's a good thing, okay? But it's really a good recipe.
It's a good thing for your wife, yeah. But for you, it's like, hey, That was a good meal.
Anyway, we got a texter said, though they are pronounced prions, okay? They are just proteins that are
misfolded.
Mm-hmm. That's why they are so scary. It's hard to detect their presence among a mass of
properly folded
proteins. When ingested, they tend to cause other adjacent proteins to untold and misfolded over time, damaging the structure from the brain. In brain protein, the results are devastating. Man, that guy's sharp, whoever that dude is.
Yeah, either that or he's got Google. And some people do have that.
One, shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, you ask me, I'm going to send you something. You got internet at home, Springer?
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, do you really think I am that far off the... Maybe I
that,
need to be.
Yeah, that laugh just sealed it, okay?
Shut up, Patrick. Anyway, there you have it. Venison baked beans. Beans. The more you eat, the more you fart. Have at it. This show is...
Instead of Google, I'm going to send you a link to this YouTube fart sounds.
Yeah, well, yeah, my wife will be proud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Springer will have a. Yeah. It's fun for a whole afternoon.
How'd the show go today, honey? Oh, well, Philip sent me a bunch of fart sounds I can use on my phone.
Yeah. I'm going to go outside and pop a cold beer and listen to these for the rest of the afternoon.
Maybe I can get them to work in chime with the singing birds.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
A little bit of, and then a, you know, whatever.
Found this on the DNR website, and it's a little short attaboy for the Walhalla State Fish Hatchery. You ever been up there?
Nope.
Need to go. They were awarded for decades of service by the National Weather Service Co-op. Because it's a weather station up there in Walhalla, basically because that was the only thing up there for years and years and years, was a fish hatchery. The weather station was established in October of 1940, operated by the U.S. Fish Hatchery, with hatchery personnel taking the observation. It gonna rain!
It's coming!
In the 1960s, the name was changed to Walhalla National Fish Hatchery. The station was manned by members of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service until 1996, when the ownership of the hatchery and the accompanying weather station was transferred to the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. They're like, oh, we'll give you the fish hatchery. We'll sell you the fish hatchery, but you still got to do weather observations up here.
Wow.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
That'll work.
The report today is it's going to be very slimy and cold. Oh, wait. Reading the wrong thermostat. The Greenville Spartanburg National Weather Service recently honored DNR's Walhalla State Fish Hatchery for their more than 75 years of official weather observation.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So.
Is that the hatchery where they have all the fish and they turn them loose, you know, where they raise them to turn them loose?
Yeah, that's a hatchery. But this is the trout hatchery. Okay. This is the cold water, trout hatchery.
We've talked about it before.
And it's a cool place, man.
Yeah. Be cool to be stationed up there, you know, watching the weather instruments next to the hatchery. Get ready for some fried fish. Just go dip you two or three out of
there. I'm sure they probably never done that.
Well, anyway.
Well, let's go to our break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about how to hunt beaver ponds for ducks.
Right here, Upstate Outdoors, 106.3 WORD. Tommy Springer, Philip Gentry, where we try to bring it to you, everything outdoors, and bring it to you and make you laugh.
Welcome back. Upstate Outdoors is on your radio, and got a couple of texts on there. My favorite one on there is from prions to fart noises. Wide range and show, boys. That's what we do.
That's what we do.
And then I don't know if that was what made the church lady mad, but we got some inappropriate language. I don't know. Is fart noises inappropriate language?
I don't know.
Sounds?
Whatever.
Well, we apologize.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's talk about don't do that again till next Saturday. Let's talk about duck hunting. You want to talk about some inappropriate language? Man, I've had some ducks.
Oh, my goodness.
Man, I tell you what, duck language
is a
killer thing. Here in the upstate, a lot of duck hunting takes place on some public waterways, but there's a lot of fighting over that. But the best place to have, you know, your own little place to hunt is a beaver pond.
Amen.
And I've got a similar situation. I've got leased property. that's on a creek, and so it don't have as many as I used to have. I think the beavers got mad. Might have had something to do with that inappropriate language. They just packed up and left.
Might have.
But beaver ponds, they dam up. Can we say dam? It's the other kind of dam, not the other, not the spring.
I got you.
Okay. They dam up the creeks, and man, the wood ducks and a few other ducks will come in there.
But mostly wood ducks.
Mostly wood ducks. Where I'm at, I mean, and I've often thought about trying to go in there and kind of, I won't say season it up because that sounds like I'm going to bait for them, but, you know, try to plant something. It's just impossible.
Yeah, and you did have some ducks on a food plot for a little while, didn't you?
Yeah.
Didn't y'all send me a picture?
Yeah, I had a food plot that I planted for deer, and the water came up, and there was wood ducks on it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, during Hurricane Michael.
Yes.
But anyway, beaver ponds are right there. They're the hunting beaver pond is an in-your-face type thing. This article is from Field and Stream, written by T. Edward Nickens. I've read a lot of his stuff. He wrote it several years ago. But talking about hunting beaver ponds, you want to get there before daylight and allow yourself plenty of time. You know, if you're fortunate, you've got an impoundment that you've made somewhere.
Right.
A lot of times, you know, you got a four wheeler trail right there. It's as easy as just riding in there, you know, throwing the four wheeler off the side, jumping in the blind, and you're ready to go in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Well, in a beaver pond, you got to have to navigate creek channels, beaver dams, boots sucking mud. So give yourself plenty of time. I agree with that 100%. The other thing is you need to get in there early because a lot of times ducks are going to come into a beaver pond before daylight. And I'm talking about before daylight, meaning before legal shooting light daylight. I've had to sit there with ducks on the water.
Yeah, you've told me those
and
stories.
And just like, please, 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 please.
Yeah.
And give some advice here. If they do land early, usually they'll stick around for a few minutes. Just sit still, sit still, sit still. Now, the other thing that the article says is to wait it out because a lot of times there will be ducks that will go somewhere else and feed, and then they'll come back to a beaver pond during the middle part of the day to kind of hang out. And I do that a lot. I did that actually earlier today. I had to go down to that same food plot that you're talking about.
It was underwater.
And I pulled the camera card on there, mm-hmm. and I jumped a couple of woodies because there are beaver ponds on either side of it. That's what flooded.
Wow.
And I jumped a couple of woodies at like 10 o'clock, and I never do that. Anytime I'm duck hunting, it's like 30 minutes and it's done. You know, it's like, hey, first 30 minutes, and then once they stop flying, I'm done with it. But a lot of times what wood ducks are bad to do is they'll land wherever they want to land, and then they'll swim in.
Yes.
And infiltrate. And the article actually gives one really dirty trick because they said beaver pond ducks are notorious for always landing where you and your decoys aren't. And you can sort of vent your frustration by hanging some aluminum pie pans over in those areas.
Wow.
I would be afraid that would spook the ducks completely out of the pond.
That's what I would be worried about.
But I guess if they want to be in there, they're going to come in there. That'll kind of push them your direction. Then they start talking about beaver pond strategies, you know, finding the right one. The right one's the one you found.
Exactly.
You know, in my experience. even older ponds, the best pond's going to have acorns dropping into it.
Yes.
Or some type of natural food source. And, you know, I've gone down to places like Park City down in Greenwood and bought or ordered stuff like Japanese millet. You know, if it gets really low during the summertime, mm-hmm. and you can put Japanese millet out or some of those seeds, you can actually take mud balls and make mud balls with the seed in them and just toss them out here and there. And that works a little bit.
Yeah.
Actually did that on a back corner of Lake Kiwi one time.
Really?
Put out stuff. Hopefully the
I'm thinking.
Hopefully. I mean,
I'm thinking here, Philip.
And I did that and went back. I didn't hunt it that year. Went back the next year. Man, it was millet everywhere. And I was like, wow, somebody got a good somebody got a good hunt
they
out
said
of that.
Thank
hopefully.
You.
Yeah. The usual suspects for a beaver pond are, like we mentioned, wood ducks. And wood ducks react very unpredictably to decoys. My experience is, except if you got decoys on a jerk cord. Okay. I can, and they still they don't decoy like other ducks would, but if they're flying overhead and they see that movement, a lot of times they'll circle back and you never see them coming. I mean, it's just like you're doing the jerk cord and all of a sudden, boom, kaploosh, yeah, he's right there.
Yeah,
I don't know that I've ever shot a wood duck coming in. It's always going out.
Right.
They land and then they get up.
Right.
Anyway, mallards. We might have a few resident mallards, but we're not in a flyway, so you know you really can't depend on that a lot. But we do have some resident ducks, black ducks. Probably not in this part of the country, although I did have a buddy of mine kill one down in Abbeville County. Gadwall, we do have a lot of gadwall that come in and later in the season. Teal, that's kind of hit or miss. So it's like Springer said, mostly it's going to be it's going to be your wood ducks. Three birds and you're done.
Yeah.
I had a buddy of mine that would wood duck hunt during duck season, and he'd be in the stand by 8 o'clock.
Right.
He'd be in the deer stand by 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
He said one time he killed his limit of three wood ducks, put them in, and he was right in front of his stand, killed his limit of wood ducks, got up in the stand, and about an hour later, nice deer came and he shot it too.
It's a good day right there.
Yeah, that's what he said. Said that was a good day.
That was a good day.
And then that article talks about some gear that you need for that and whatever. You need a pair of waders, chest waders, muck chair. I ain't toting no chair in there. I put on a shell belt.
Right.
Because I'm not going to get more than a box of shots. Because, right. I mean, it's only three birds. It's wood ducks. If I can't hit them with 25 shells,
you need to go home.
I'm not
anyway.
Going to get 25 shots
right.
anyway.
True enough.
And a gun and a belt and a pair of chest waders, mm-hmm. and I just find something to lean up against.
Excellent.
Maybe a couple of wood duck decoys on a jerk cord. So, there you go.
That's
duck season
stuff.
Will be here in, what, 2 weeks?
Yeah. I'll know when it's in
weeks.
There here, too, because, you know, from my back porch, as the crow flies, the Tiger River, South Tiger River, is just right there.
You hear him in the evening?
No, it's that morning, dude. That morning, it right at when the sunlight, it's about 35, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
That's it. So, and it's every year. So, I don't know what, you know, probably wood ducks, a good bit of them.
Well, when you get those planted, yeah. Like if somebody's got something fixed on an impoundment or
I'm
something
sure.
like that, you get a lot of mergansers in there, too.
Maybe, too.
But hairy heads, they call them.
I can hear them from the back porch, man.
Long darts.
Because the dogs are going to get me up every morning, same time, and it's still just a little bit dark when I let them out the door. And, yeah, I can sit out there. I'll wait on it.
I love sitting in the deer stand this time of year now and hear the wood ducks flying around. I hadn't heard a lot this year, but that doesn't mean they're not somewhere.
If I was ever going to get a duck mounted,
yep.
It would be a wood duck.
I got a wood duck mounted.
It's a beautiful bird.
And I got a hooded merganser mounted.
That's a cool looking duck.
That is that's a long dart.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Exactly.
You got that big long beak.
Yeah.
That's a pretty bird. That's two I got mounted. Well, let's go to our break. Then when we come back, we're going to ring up our buddy Kyle Clark. We're going to jump back into the CWD, chronic wasting disease, and talk about what a ban on deer lures would mean.
Right here, Upstate Outdoors, 106.3 WORD. Tommy Springer, Phillip Gentry. Going to take a quick break. Be back on the other side.
Well, earlier in the show, we were talking to Charles Ruth, the deer project coordinator with South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, about a proposed ban. And it's not even in the works, but it's something that I don't think they'll get a whole lot of resistance from the legislation once they decided to pull that trigger. But in the meantime, they'll do a lot of public consensus and probably talking with some industry folks. You know, obviously you want to make sure that you're not putting folks out of business
Amen
or anything
that.
Like that. And so being ahead of the curve, as Upstate Outdoors frequently is, we decided to call our buddy Kyle Clark, owner of Doc's Deer Sense. Well, co-owner. Actually, Cherie's the brains behind the business. But
who knows everything there is to know about.
Kyle's the muscle.
Deer pee.
And, Kyle, welcome to Upstate Outdoors.
Thank you, guys. How you doing?
We're doing great, Kyle.
I've been
good. Thinking about you ever since I seen that headline a few weeks ago. Really been thinking about you, bro.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And it's something that's happening, you know, it seems to be more of a conversation these days all across the country or the whitetail range. You know, nationwide, more so now than ever. And I didn't get to hear Charles's segment, and I apologize for that. I'm actually on the road right now to Ohio to deer hunt for the next week myself. So I pulled over here to stop and have a conversation with you guys. So.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate that. And Charles really was talking about preventative measures and, basically that we don't want to take a chance. And I get all of that. And one of the questions that I would ask you is what's your opinion on how big – I mean, is this a big threat to deer wherever the chronic wasting disease, or do you think maybe this might be more media?
Well, I mean, chronic wasting disease it's very serious when it, you know, wherever it raises its head at. And unfortunately for us, we haven't, to my knowledge, had any down here in the South, because a lot, I think, has to do with our environment down here as far as the weather. However, as far as we're talking about this, as it pertains to the ability of CWD to be spread via urine, specifically deer scents, I think that there's a lot of cloudy data out there. And I think that we in the scent industry want nothing more than to protect, the wild whitetails of North America, more so than anybody. I mean, we make our living off of these animals, off of hunters and off of the hunting industry and the ability to hunt whitetail. So the last thing we want to see is something go wrong, to where vast numbers of whitetail across the country are affected. That's why, a number of years ago, a group of us, founded what's known as the ATA Deer Protection Program. And I'd like to hit on a few points about that program, Phil.
Absolutely. Okay? Go ahead.
Absolutely.
Okay. So back when we started noticing this ban thing starting to kind of take a snowball effect, I think it was the year that Virginia put their ban in place, a group of us in the hunting industry, in the scent industry specifically, got together in partnership with the ATA and formed what's become known as the ATA Deer Protection Program. What that is we put a set of self-policing guidelines, best industry practices, if you will, on ourselves that supersede the level, they're stricter than the level of what any DNR in the United States currently requires for captive whitetail and deer farming and urine collection. The logic there being that using the ATA's governing body, they could lobby the different DNRs all over the country and meet with them and say, hey, we have this group of scent companies and urine collectors that have band together, and we're already operating our farms and facilities at a level that's stricter than what your state requires. As a result, there's no risk of our companies bringing CWD to your state, so that therefore there's no reason to ban our products outright. Some of the things that the Deer Protection Program brings to the table are, a lot of people think that, deer farms are just out there importing and exporting and selling and buying deer willy-nilly, and that's really not the case. If you are a collection facility that comes on board with the Deer Protection Program, one of the requirements of you is a prohibition on import of live whitetail, meaning you have to become a closed facility. Some other issues that you have is our facilities undergo 100% inspection. That means every deer on the property every 3 years, and at least 20% physical inspection of every year by accredited veterinarian. The facilities also undergo an annual inspection by an accredited veterinarian that includes physical animal inspection, a herd inventory review, and an overall herd health and facility inspection, including the fencing. Participants must double fence along their perimeter if they're within 30 miles of a confirmed CWD case in the wild or captive deer, some of the manufacturers require that facilities that we work with are double fenced regardless of if they're in proximity to an affected case. And the other thing is the 8 or 9 urine collection facilities that are in the ATA Deer Protection Program provide urine for 95% to 99% of the scent companies that you find on the market today, whether it be online or at the big box retailers or at the local archery shops all across the country. I mean, our partners provide urine to all but a couple percent of the whole industry. Mm-hmm. And we are – one thing that I'm hoping will happen out of this is we really need – one question we often get asked and that one that our the people who were kind of arguing against or for a urine ban often say is, yeah, but the ATA Deer Protection Program is not an accredited program. It's not, you know, so what about that? And it's not law. So we can't force deer and scent companies to join. So one thing that I would like to see happen is, okay, if we're not an accredited program, why aren't we? I mean, if this is such a big deal, if this is such a huge issue across the entire white-tailed deer range, why hasn't the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Commission stepped in on the national level, on the federal level, and worked with us to become an accredited program so we can answer that question, you know, with confidence and further confirm to states and to customers that there's nothing to worry about. The scent industry would, especially our group, would be more than willing to not only participate in something like that, but to actually help fund the inspectors who would come by and inspect our facilities for the annual basis.
And I mean,
you would think that
the feds would get involved in that, especially when you're talking about something that's interstate involving something that spreads from different states, rather than individual DNRs, you know, kind of trying to take the lead on that. You would think that that the feds would have more say in regulations for that.
For sure. I would love to see the federal level them step in and tell us what's required of us to become a quote unquote accredited program above and beyond what we're currently doing. And secondly, you know, if this is such a big deal, which I believe that it is, make it a law. Make it a law that if you are a scent company or a deer farm or you collect urine for a scent company, that you must be an accredited herd. Because that's, you know, what we're missing right now is that there's nothing in place to, you know, it benefits all scent companies to be a part of it because it's a industry best practice, but there's nothing forcing them to do it. I mean, if there was a law in place at the federal level that said, if you want to sell these products or if you want to collect urine for these companies who sell these products, you have to be an accredited herd and you have to work within these parameters. And by not doing so, it cuts a little bit of the legs out from what we're able to do. We can't take it as far as we want to. We can't, you know, really get everything in place nationally to protect, you know, every herd in the state, every wild herd in the state, in each state.
Well, Kyle, let me ask you this. You know, when this subject came up, especially here in South Carolina, and I know you've had extensive conversations with Charles Ruth. Do you think there's some middle ground that can be reached that will both, you know, protect your business and also protect the South Carolina deer herd?
Well, I hope so. And I think that this, you know, the going to an outright ban, I understand where Charles is coming from and I understand where the DNR of South Carolina is coming from, and that's the easiest, safest, cheapest way is to just say no more. We're not going to allow these products to be sold or used by hunters or outdoor stores in our state. I get it, but like we just pointed out, I mean, I think it's jumping the gun a little bit because we're open and willing to work on the highest levels to become an accredited program, as well as, you know, we're already operating our facilities and operating our companies at a level of monitoring that's higher than what all state DNRs currently have. In fact, the state of Michigan and the state of Montana have adopted our policies, the ATA Deer Protection Program guidelines, as their new state minimum. So we're doing something right. You know, I mean, if those states abandon what they previously had in place to adopt ours because they were stricter and better and a better way of doing things. You know, the other thing, so I think I hope that there is some middle ground to talk here, especially with with us being open to doing what needs done to become accredited and to become a standalone force that helps, you know, to preserve whitetail for generations to come.
Well, speaking specifically of CWD, what could be done to try to detect that specific threat in the captive deer herd?
Well, right now, there is no, to my, now, I'm not a wildlife biologist, so I don't know if you can tell that by talking to me, but let me put that out there. But to my understanding, there currently is no test that exists for testing a live whitetail for CWD. However, we have in the works, and the ATA Deer Protection Program has in the works and is working towards, we're hoping in the next season or two, a test of our product to be able to test the level of CWD prions in collected urine before it goes out the farm door to make sure that it's CWD free. So if we can do that, then we've virtually eliminated the ability for our products to introduce CWD into the wild, which we already are with the parameters that are currently set in place. You know, so I also think that some of the research that's out there, it doesn't exactly apply to real life. A lot of it is done in labs. There was a study, and forgive me, I can't cite where it was at, but there was a study done that infected lab rats with CWD. And they used this as with CWD infected urine. They got lab rats to come down with it. So, and they use this as the springboard to say, here it is, here's the data. Urine carries CWD and can be transferred to animals. What they don't say is that, A, this was done in a lab. B, this was done with rats, which is, you know, are significantly smaller than deer. Three, they were intracranially injected with chronic wasting disease. That means directly into the brain. And that chronic wasting disease injection was almost 10 times more potent than what a real whitetail could realistically ever come down with. So, you know, I think there's information out there that the public isn't always getting. And the other thing that we hear a lot about is that CWD prions or prions can be expelled by a deer. So a deer in the woods that's infected, or a hunter carrying a bottle of deer scent, can pour it out over a mock scrape, and it can bind to those prions, can physically bind to the grass and bind to the leaves so that they won't wash away, and they sit there for weeks or months or years, and could potentially infect generations of deer from this one guy dumping one bottle of urine on the ground. So our counter to that statement is that based on the potency or the potency of the prions in normal infected CWD urine, it would take, for example, 23 one-ounce bottles of urine from a CWD-positive deer to even match what's known as a sub-infectious dose, meaning a dose that's too small to infect a whitetail. Let's assume a regular usage of one bottle per year for a hunter, it would take greater than 23 years of application to the same tree or the same mock scrape, each year having been unlucky enough to find and purchase a bottle from a CWD positive deer, which we've already said we've virtually eliminated that ability, and hoping with the test of the urine that we're trying to do would 100% eliminate it. It just not even makes it remotely possible based on the collection procedures and testing requirements that we observe. But urine's often not even applied to the ground. It's most commonly used on wicks. There's minimal amounts, if any, that's dispensed into the environment. So, I mean, a lot of the data out there is kind of skewed to what they want the narrative to be.
Awesome. Kyle Clark, Doc's Deer
Sense. Stay on top of it, Kyle.
Yeah, let us know, man. We might need to get you in the studio to discuss this a little bit more. And good luck in Ohio.
Happy hunting.
Awesome. Let's go to our break. When we come back, Springer will mumble through the calendar of events, and then we'll wrap up with a parting shot.
Upstate Outdoors, 106.3 WORD. Stay tuned.
It's time for the calendar of events. Take it away, Mr. Springer.
All right, coming up November the 6th, we got a free youth deer clinic. That will be next weekend, Belfast WMA on Tuesday. Actually, it's Tuesday of this coming week. Parents are encouraged to join in.
Kids out of school.
Yeah, with their youth ages 10 to 17 to learn. I don't know what for, but for something. I don't know, kick a teacher day. I don't know. To learn about cooking, game, care, preparation, marksmanship, and tree stand safety. And for more information about the clinic and or application, please contact Mariana at masonm@dnr.sc.gov. Also coming up, big time, down the road on November the 10th and 11th with our buddy Tom Mundy and Fish Stalker Lures. He will be doing seminars both days. From 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. will be a seminar. The seminar on Saturday as well as Sunday. 11 a.m. to 12 will be question and answer. They'll take a break for lunch and then back at 1 to 2 for seminar and 2 to 3 for questions and answers. And from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., fishing section hangout. Martha Goodfellow's going to be there as well.
Yeah.
And also,
she's going to talk about drop shotting.
Yeah, probably. And also, Santa Claus will be showing up that day as well.
Santa?
Yeah, we might know him too. He might know something about fishing as well.
You're not Santa. You smell like fish. Corn and fish. Salmon eggs and fish.
Coming up December the 15th, we got the Tower Shoot Pheasant Hunt at the Clinton House. Our buddies make a difference for a child at Christmas. There will be two hunts, different prices. Morning hunt, shoot is at 9:30 to 12. Afternoon hunts, 1 to 3. And for more information, you can contact our buddy Oscar McCurry at 864-225-8704 or email at McCurry'sOutboard@bellsouth.net.
Ta-da!
And that's a calendar event for this week.
Awesome. Well, now, let's see if Patrick's ready for...
he just said you were number one.
Patrick.
The work camaraderie here is fantastic. I
got
it.
One word for you, Patrick. Jalapenos.
There you go, Dad.
Yeah. All right. Well, Wisconsin's inaugural elk hunt sees the permit winner cited for illegally killing elk. What?
What? Hold on. Let me do it right. What?
What? Unfortunately, the first elk killed in Wisconsin by a non-tribal member, because apparently they let Indians kill elk, you know, on a different schedule.
Dances with wolves, man.
His first time in more than a century was shot illegally. A man from Franklin, Wisconsin, has been cited for illegally killing a bull elk during the state's inaugural elk hunt. Joe Wiltzius, 73, was cited by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for shooting a bull elk on October 15th. Will Zilcius allegedly shot the bull as it stood on Forest Road 174 in Round Lake Township in Sawyer County. Why didn't he just hit it with a truck like Springer does?
Bingo.
Wiltzius's name was drawn for one of the five coveted permits in a lottery that saw thousands of non-tribal applicants apply. That's kind of, how can they do that?
Man,
if you're a tribal, you can't apply?
That's that. I'm cool with it.
All right, I don't want to get into that. The hunt is the first regulated elk hunt in Wisconsin history. Five permits were open to Wisconsin residents, and five were allotted to American Indian tribes. You know, I'm part Indian, but I won't get into that.
Yeah.
Four of the five resident permits were drawn from a pool of 38,000 resident applicants. Applications. While the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation raffled off one permit, Wiltzius was the winner of the RMEF raffle, mm-hmm. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation.
Correct.
Now, state hunting regulations prohibit discharging a firearm from across a roadway. An investigation revealed that Wiltzius was standing on or near Forest Road 174 when he shot. He was also charged with hunting within 50 feet of the center line of a roadway. He was hunting with a guide and a friend when the incident occurred. The guide and a friend were not expected to be charged. However, he could be losing his license. So,
not good. Yeah.
Bad news. Should have hit it with a car like Springer did. Hey, want to thank Charles Ruth, and also Kyle Clark for being on the show today. That's the end of our show. Take us home, Springer.
And everybody that joined us on the text line as well as the call-in. Love you. Mean it. See you next week. Talk to you next week. Get outside and cleanse your soul. God bless.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.